You are listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Preference with your host, Hedda.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Get Kids Outdoors Dinner on Friday, October 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust in Portland. The Get Kids Outdoors Dinner supports Betty's 360 and Urban Nature Partners, two youth mentoring organizations that look to create more equitable access to the outdoors for historically marginalized communities in Portland. There will be dinner, drinks, silent auctions, raffles, and the opportunity to learn more about both organizations. Again, that's the Get Kids Outdoors Dinner on Friday, October 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center at EcoTrust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Off of the strip, in the outskirts and in the fringes, in the corner, out of the grip. I think I must be
Welcome, dear listeners. Thanks for tuning in. This is Preference Radio. I'm your host, Hedda. That was Suzanne Vega, left of center, from the Pretty in Pink soundtrack. Playing piano on that track, the fabulous Joe Jackson, who's now out as bisexual. Before we get into tonight's conversation, I want to invite you to an event this Saturday, Thrill the World Portland. This is our 13th year holding this event, this thriller dance, as part of a worldwide simultaneous thriller dance. We're almost a Portland institution now. We'd love to have you join us in zombie costume or not, as a dancer or not. We'll be at Irving Park Saturday afternoon. There's still time to learn the dance, the full thriller dance. You can join us at our practice earlier on Saturday, or you can find instructional videos online, Thrill the World Instructional, and you will find them. This is a benefit. We invite donations at the event. It's a benefit for KBOO for the third year in a row. For the 10 years before that, I'm getting old with this event, I think. It was a benefit for Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center here in town, SMRC. Once they came under the aegis of New Avenues for Youth, they invited us to find other folks who might need the proceeds more, and so we settled on KBOO, and we're gonna come dance. We're gonna have a Bollywood thriller first, DJ Prashant's Bollywood choreography of a thriller dance. It's sweet, it's beautiful, and then we'll be dancing thriller. So I'm super excited. I'd love to see you there, and look for us online, Thriller World Portland. We've got lots of Facebook pages and information elsewhere. This is Preference. We're in the QT Boo slot Tuesday evenings between 6 and 7. We have queer and trans programming every single week. So thanks for joining us. In the studio, we have Patrick Calivia and Teresa Dark Lady Reed. Why don't you say hi?
Well, hello there.
Good evening.
Thanks for being here. I'm so grateful for this show. And your presence in it. Patrick, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, let's see, where do I start? When you get to be my age, you wind up with this whole life story that can be hard to condense. I've been out of the closet, as we used to call it, since 1971, and have a family that is blue-collar and Mormon. My dad's a coal miner. My mom was a housewife, or she was until she kicked my dad out. Then she had to become a career woman, and suddenly she knew what feminism was all about. I am a transgendered man who did not transition until I was 45, and prior to that I was very active in the Leather Dyke community. I'm an author. I've been a therapist in private practice for 20 years, working with sex and gender minorities. And I live with several hidden disabilities. So we have so many things we could talk about.
Yeah. Dark Lady?
Who am I?
Yeah.
I'm currently the owner of Catalyst, a sex-positive place on Southeast Foster. And I am also a writer. I was the editor of Exotic Magazine for 3 years before it became an inferior publication, in my opinion. And I work for Adult Video News Magazine out of Los Angeles.
Wonderful. Patrick.
Oh, yes.
Let's start with your writing.
Well, okay.
If you could give us sort of an overview of what it is that you focus on.
Well, I think I started writing about sexuality because it was such a huge issue in the family I grew up in. Mormonism is not exactly known for endorsing variation or self-knowledge or autonomy. And unfortunately, I think I went looking for a community where things would be different. And what I found in the lesbian community of Salt Lake City was that it really wasn't very different. And so with all the struggles that I had sort of understanding my own body, understanding other people's bodies, figuring out how to have pleasure in my life that wasn't the sanctioned reproductive missionary position and the dead bug position, as we also call it. I really wanted to do sex education that would be relevant for queer people. And so the first book I wrote was a sex ed manual for women who have sex with other women called Sophistry. And then I started to address other issues that have to do with social control over pleasure and the political implications of rebelling against that.
Mm-hmm. When you say you were struggling to find what you needed in, I guess, the lesbian community in Salt Lake, is that right?
Oh, yes.
What we're talking, I suppose, then the early 70s, mid-70s?
I came out in 1971 when I was 17.
Yeah. What was that experience for you?
It was pretty horrible. I think that, sorry, one of the things that people don't understand is how much the demographic of gay populations and sexual and gender minorities in general evolve over time as liberation increases and equality becomes closer. More people are out of the closet and are visible as part of those groups. Basically, the only people that you found in the gay community of 1971 were people who were outed by maybe their gender difference, maybe by some kind of unfortunate catastrophe in their lives. And so it was a pretty wounded community of folks who really struggled to survive. There was a lot of anti-gay violence. The lesbian bar where I went frequently witnessed police harassment, straight men coming in to bash on the queers, and it was just a really scary, although exhilarating time. I was involved in working against the war in Vietnam. I was involved in early efforts to try to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. I did direct action at Temple Square. That was tons of fun. And so I think that what I felt like was true in my life then was just that either you fought back or you just gave up and died. And so then as now, I think if you're on the edge of a struggle for more space in the world that we live in, that is basically still the choice that you have, but it's become a less obvious choice. I would think that the best way to describe the sexual culture of that lesbian community was that it was very repressed and yet sadly still offered women a lot more options than your typical heterosexual marriage did. I'll just give one example, which is probably a story Teresa's already tired of, but I was told as a young, underage, female-bodied person that the first thing you should do if you went home with someone from the bar was check her medicine cabinet. And if she had mouthwash in her medicine cabinet, it meant she was a terribly dirty person who probably did oral sex.
No.
And so you should just go home and not engage with her. So that's kind of unimaginable now, I think. I think most lesbians would just laugh at that story, but that was the ground, the existential ground that I kind of found myself on. You look so shocked.
I'd love to hear the explanation when she walks in and says, "Why are you in my medicine cabinet anyway?"
Exactly.
I think we expect that of all of our hookups, that they'll the first place that they'll go to find anything.
Oh, I know. Isn't it? It's really sad to me, you know, that there was so little information, and the basic attitude then was that you never wanted to be someone's first same-sex experience, because that was a terrible thing to do to somebody, to, quote, make them gay, unquote, for the rest of their life. So I waited for a year to come out, really, until I could meet someone else who also was brand new to the community. And all of the older female-bodied people around us were not going to have anything to do with us until that point. So, yeah. I mean, I think that if we want, I think it's easy to kind of downplay sexual liberation and sex education as middle class causes that don't have anything to do with genuine liberation. But the fact is that these are issues that have to do with self-possession, autonomy, ownership of our own bodies, and that when you're able to make a difference in the quality of somebody's sexuality, you are able to free up so much of their energy and make a real difference in their quality of life. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sorry that that's been the primary cause of my work.
Yeah. So from there, sort of what was next for you?
Moving to San Francisco. I was lucky enough to pick up a trick in Perky's, the lesbian bar, one night, and she told me that I needed to get out of Salt Lake. That winter it snowed until all the cars on my street were buried, and I decided that she was right. So I bought a bus ticket to San Francisco. The only thing I took with me really was books, and just left. And, I arrived in San Francisco probably in 1975. There were no gay rights laws then. It was before Harvey Milk had been elected to public office. But there was still a huge, to me at least, gay community that offered me a lot more opportunities for activism, for a social life, for culture. I got involved with the Daughters of Bilitis, which was a very early lesbian organization founded by Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, and eventually started working at The Advocate, publishing articles for them.
I think, too, that one of the things I noticed becoming part of a more urban gay community was the fact that all of a sudden we were all pretending that we grew up in big cities and we were all middle class. And the fact is that working class queer people are still largely invisible, certainly not represented in the media. I think there's a tendency for our larger organizations to want to portray us as a moneyed population with a high education and disposable income so that we're more attractive to advertisers and to politicians. But the fact is that most of us are working class, and we've been living in a recession for at least the last 15 years, an unacknowledged recession. And often when we come out, we lose whatever class privilege we had if our families throw us out. So I would like to see a more nuanced understanding of how class origins affect who we are in the world and what we want and what we need from movements for social change. Do I sound like a commie?
Only a little.
Only a little.
Insurrectionist.
When did you first find yourself getting into organizing around BDSM issues?
Okay, that's a good question. I think I had fantasies about what we call BDSM now, or kink, since I was a pretty small kid, and had enormous ambivalence and guilt about it. And at least part of the draw of the women's movement was that it really promised to cure that sort of thing. Kate Millett has written some pretty famous stuff on the topic of what she called female masochism, really saying that it's an artifact of patriarchy, an artifact of the colonization of women's bodies. So if you claim your power and your full of self-love and blah, 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 then all that is just supposed to go away. Now, that certainly wasn't my experience. And so I took advantage of San Francisco sex information training. I was a volunteer there. I started meeting people through that organization who were also involved in the leather community. and in particular met a woman named Cynthia Slater, who had founded the Society of Janus there. And she was a professional dominatrix and a bisexual woman who hung out with the gay leather men because she thought that the straight SM scene was very lame. And because of her work with Janus and being able to get education through that group, I started encountering these radical concepts around consent, negotiation, safety, and understanding that really SM or kink was not about self-hatred or self-destruction. It was about, and it was about multiplying sensation. It was about role-playing and fantasy. And you really wanted to keep yourself and your partner around so that you could repeat the experience on another evening when you were both available in your very busy social calendar. So, yeah.
What was the question?
It's just a, what is organizing around kinky shows or BDSM mean for you, Teresa?
Well, like Patrick, I grew up in a very blue-collar household. My father spent 30 years in the military before retiring as a janitor. And my mother was a Catholic housewife. So there was a lot of conflict and ignorance in the household. And I found out about sex on literally on the streets of Portland. And it was really important to me that that not be how other people find out about sex. I wanted to be able to provide space where sexuality could be discussed openly and honestly, and people could connect with each other and find resources. And I stumbled across the queer community in high school in the 70s, got off of a bus and walked into a Pride celebration in, I think, 78 or 79. I know there were women with no shirts on. It was so exciting. And by introducing more and more types of people into my life, I started learning more and more about what was out there, and that what I had been raised with was not good information and was not something to necessarily pass along or retain for a long period of time. I'd had kinky thoughts, but had not met anyone that was openly kinky until the 80s. Not even openly, actually. I discovered that a boyfriend was kinky because he wrecked our car, and there was a box full of kinky photos and news cuttings and things, photos from TV Guide and the like of women tied up, and I was not sure what to make of that. So nothing really happened until the early 90s, when I had friends who were poly and kinky, and they introduced me to the local communities, and I started dabbling in both and introducing them to each other. And the whole concept of community in Portland, I think, has just really evolved and changed over the last couple decades, and it's been kind of exciting to see that happen. Though, you know, now we don't have Embers, which changes the landscape and the demographics, I think, a lot. It'll be interesting to see how the city continues to work around that absence.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the reasons why I started writing sexually explicit fiction was because I couldn't find any representations of people like myself or my friends. And I felt like one of the things that you get from fiction is a signal about what options you might have in your life. You know, the idea that there are choices and that there are actually people who are doing some of the things that maybe you're contemplating in your private moments. And I think it's important to remember that in the late 70s, when I started publishing, the whole concept of consent was just sort of missing from the public discourse. I mean, there were no battered women. There were just women. You know, the whole idea of rape being a crime within marriage hadn't entered the legal code yet. And so for kinky people to stand up and say, well, I believe in consent, and I think it's very important to talk about what you're going to do before you do it, and take care to make sure that everybody's happy with what takes place, was just a shocking notion on several levels. And it's made me really happy to see the way that various conventions that originated in the kink or the queer community have kind of migrated into vanilla sexuality and into heterosexuality now. That makes, if I've had anything to do with that, then that's a good legacy.
And we know that it's out there because the right wing has latched on to some of those tropes, and consent is really upsetting them. I believe it was it Bill O'Reilly? There was one of those ilk who was complaining about the introduction of consent into dialogue and relationships, and that this was just some crazy liberal, you know, gay idea that was going to destroy relationships and marriages. I think that there are people who are more upset about the concept of explicit consent than they are about the things that we're consenting to do.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
This is Preference. We're talking with Patrick Calavia and Teresa Darklady Reed. Patrick, I want to jump forward a long way from where we left off. I want to hear about where you're at, if you want to talk about this, on your gender journey now.
Okay, I'm 65, and one of the things that happened in my mid-40s was that my mother began a lengthy process of dying from metastatic breast cancer. And that was a life-changing event on so many levels. I mean, one of the things I realized was that my mom had found a lump in her breast and ignored it for 10 years, at which point it was impossible to treat. And she basically did that because she didn't want to have a doctor dealing with her naked body, you know? Which was just so tragic, and it's this thing that I still grieve about, you know, that my mom's inhibitions around sexuality basically cost her life. My mom had never been happy about the fact that I had same-sex relationships, and I had never really talked to her about being bisexual because I didn't want to give her hope that someday I might convert and settle down and get married. And a weird thing that was sort of an offshoot of all of this was that I realized that if I wanted to transition, I could do it without having a conversation with my mother about it. Now, that probably sounds really cowardly, but after 3 or 4 decades of dealing with her homophobia and her repulsion, her disappointment, her fear and loathing, I could not really face a conversation with her about being a transgender person. I was so far outside of her frame of reference. I have to say things haven't gone particularly well with the rest of my family about that. But at the age of 45, I was having symptoms of menopause. I went to see my doctor. She said, well, we could put you on estrogen. And I had a meltdown and cried in her office and said, you know what? I will never put that poison in my body on purpose. Not ever. Took me a really long time to find a doctor who did not already have an opinion about who I was, who was willing to let me take testosterone. And I just sort of took it one step at a time. I said to myself, if at any point I feel like I'm not doing the right thing or I'm not happy with these changes, then I'll just quit. And instead, what I found was that every step I took along the road to a male identity made me feel happier, more at ease, and more comfortable. So I've been living in a male identity for 20 years now. And the only thing that I'm sorry about is that this wasn't something that I did earlier in my life. You know, I mean, I had investigated the possibility of transition when I was younger, but in my late 20s, all of the options for transitioning were through gender clinics at medical schools, and they were very much in the business of churning out trans women and trans men who would pass and who would be heterosexual. So I knew that if I went to one of those clinics, I probably would not make it through the screening process. Mm-hmm. So I abandoned that. I was already deeply involved in the feminist sex wars and all of that mishigas, and I just could not see taking on one more controversial component of my identity at that point in time. Maybe that was a mistake. There certainly were guys who did transition in the 70s and 80s. But
out of curiosity, do you think that there's an ideal time when a trans-identified person would begin transitioning? I know it's very controversial about hormone blockers in pre-adolescent.
Right. I one of my earliest memories is having a conversation with my parents and my grandparents about being a boy and their ridicule and their crazy backlash against that. And I think that for a lot of folks who are differently gendered, we do know from a very early age that the expectations we're meeting with from school, parents, the rest of our families, just aren't matching up with who we feel like we are inside. So what is the ideal age? That is a really tricky question, and I think it has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. The thing that I do know is that often when people are not allowed to transition, they don't survive. And so I don't think any of us should have to commit suicide or destroy ourselves in other ways just because we are hardwired to express our gender in a way that society is not going to validate.
Let's talk about power. We've been sort of talking about the power that we have to define ourselves versus the power that other people want to express to define us on their terms. Let's talk about power in relationships. That could be... Go ahead.
Michel Foucault said the power was never a simple and straightforward dynamic. There's never a case of one person has power and another person does not. And I think that's a very valid point, that even in male-female dynamics, men may have greater power than women do, relatively speaking, but if men have power in the public domain, women have power in the private domain.
Well, should we define terms too? Do we want to define power versus authority?
That's a very, very good question. They are not the same thing, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, you can have very powerful individuals who are not in positions of authority. The hand that rocks the cradle, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. What has this come up for you?
Well, in particular, right now, I'm thinking about kink relationships and power negotiation, and how so often that sort of power is almost contracted and temporary, and we're so used to thinking of power as embedded in some role, but instead we have these opportunities to take on power negotiations that are very temporary, very short term, and very much about expression rather than authority. And I'm interested in that.
Well, that is a very interesting distinction, I think, and it also highlights issues of if you are in a kinky dynamic, who has the power exactly? It's kind of become a byword in the as some community that it's really the bottom who has the most power, because they are the one who is being basically catered to by a top who wants to make sure that they get their fantasy fulfilled. I think that's a little too simplistic of a reading of the situation. I think in an ideal situation, the top is fulfilling some of their own deep needs, and that role is consistent with their sexuality and also other components of their personality. I know that when I top people, there are parts there about nurturing, about fostering transcendence, about being simply maybe in a situation where I'm polarized. And I think that there's a difference in sexuality between people who enjoy polarization and then perhaps people who enjoy a mirroring, where instead of the polarization, what they're getting out of intimacy is that they feel the same, or that the other person they're with is their equivalent, their reflection, and understands. And I don't know a better term to use than mirroring there. I'm not speaking about narcissism, really, but I do think that there are so many different ways to look at sexual orientation, and it's not necessarily about the gender of your partner. What do you think about these issues?
I agree with you. I admit I'm getting lost in all of our webs here, talking about authority and power and the nurturing. It really assumes a very strong black and white sort of situation, which I find it's usually shades of gray.
Oh no, not 50 shades of gray.
No, not 50 shades of gray. There are not 50 shades of gray. One big damn gray spot. Oh, I said a word. I said spot. I think that ideally there's a synergy going on between the person who's engaging in the activity and the person who's receiving the activity, if you will, topping and bottoming, and that everybody's getting something fulfilled. So there's some need and some pleasure that they're supplying for each other, because without the other, you've mostly got masturbation, really. You need the top and the bottom to create that circuit, to finish that circuit. I like to joke that the bottom has the power because the bottom, well, both sides can use a safe word. Tops can safe word. People forget that.
Right.
It's true.
Well, and I've always enjoyed the experience of encountering a bottom who's a very powerful person and very autonomous, smart, you know, clever in their own way. And then watching the change in status, the change in experience, maybe helping that person be more in touch with their body and less up in their head. And I also like that experience of going down with them, watching them go down, and then the next day having that basic equality be restored. Mm-hmm. So I would agree with you, Alan, that there's something really luscious about the temporary, albeit intense, nature of an SM scene. I think it's delicious and paradoxical and quite intoxicating.
Well, it can be such a nice experience as a bottom to relinquish control, to let someone else have that power and authority, right, for a certain amount of time. I mean, it's a trope, but it's a true trope about people who in their mundane lives often experience a lot of responsibility and are often in positions of authority, who find relief by submitting or bottoming and experiencing, you know, letting things happen to themselves and not being in control. Can be a real pleasure to just sort of, here, you drive for a little while.
And yet at the same time, we have lots of people in our community who don't identify as top or bottom, who are basically switches.
Those switches, like bisexuals, they're so selfish.
Just upsetting the apple cart all over the
everything.
Place. Yes. So it's, I think it's amazing how new roles and new forms of self-understanding are always evolving, so that it's part of why I've continued to write and to teach about sexuality, because there's never any point where you can stop and say, well, I understand it all and now this is it.
Though I've met people who have said those things. You have reached the end of the internet.
They are largely misguided.
They are definitely misguided. At Catalyst, we meet a lot of younger people too, and it's pretty exciting to meet an 18 or 19 year old pervy kid who has all these new ideas about how to identify themselves and how to refer to themselves. We've talked a lot about pronouns during the last year, and then to introduce people from previous generations into that dialogue and to see all the minds kind of sparking as they start rethinking things they thought had been established is I think it's exciting. It's like watching the English language continue to grow. Mm-hmm. Our sexuality is not, there's no wall keeping us in or out except the ones that we, I think, erect for ourselves.
Well, you know, Teresa, if we're going to acknowledge switches within the leather community, I think we have to acknowledge the presence of non-binary people in the mm-hmm. in the community of trans or differently gendered folks. And that's important. I mean, there are also intersex people who have a whole different set of challenges and political issues. So, again, I think... you have to just keep up to date mm-hmm. as best you can with the ways that each successive generation of agitation, education, demand for social reform and social justice sort of begets its own challenges and its own further evolution. And some people are able to, as activists, kind of ride with that, and other people get very bitter about it. You know? I mean, just look at the term queer. When I came mm-hmm. out, that word was usually accompanied by a beer can being thrown in your direction. It certainly wasn't a term of radical self-affirmation. And there's still a lot of people my own age who are same-sex loving who will not use the word queer to describe themselves.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
I think even for me, it's a slippery word to use.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like to ask folks who come on the show if they're willing to tell me what they think queer is for them.
I like the word because it's a sort of an umbrella term. And I think I also like it because I associate it with Queer Nation. Mm-hmm. And some of the most heartbreaking memories of my life have to do with the early years of the AIDS epidemic and just losing so many people to that awful disease while Ronald Reagan sat in the White House and refused to even use the word AIDS and certainly did nothing to change public policy and look for any kind of treatment or research even into the cause of it. And so when Queer Nation came along and ACT UP came along and people were doing direct action, demanding some change in those areas, to me it was just a breath of hope and the first ray of sunshine and optimism I'd had for a really long time. I think I also like the term queer because I've never felt like I was just gay. As a person who's been interested in most other genders and been active with men and with women and with trans folks, I like that word because it fits me a little better than gay or homosexual. And I think, too, with when you have a kinky component to your identity, you need to have some kind of term for the way that you're different that isn't necessarily linked to gender preferences. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it?
Well, I like the term because it's got a nice umbrella element to it. It can include a lot of different diversity there. I have not tended to apply it to myself since I've lived a pretty heteronormative lifestyle in a lot of ways. You give me that look. Okay, I live in a strange and magical world where what I do seems heteronormative. I felt that it was something that if it was going to be applied to me, I would rather someone else use it before I take it on myself.
Well, do you think people who are poly, do they qualify as queer?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. I mean, I like queer because I like its old-timey meanings, you know, to be unique and a little strange and
odd, eccentric, whimsical.
Those are words I use on my resume, for instance, which is why I'm largely unemployable. But let's move on. But because I've always been kind of strange and wonderful, mostly strange. But so I think that's a topic for debate. I mean, are swingers queer?
Ooh, we'd have to ask them.
That's right. I would bet that the average swinger, and this is going out on a limb perhaps, would not embrace the term queer.
Right. Although I do think they constitute a sexual minority.
Certainly.
Yeah. So.
Let's talk about Catalyst.
What would you like to know?
Everything.
Everything. Well, we just celebrated our, oh, good Lord, what was it? It was, now I'm wondering, was it 4 years at the space we're in. And then we were in North Portland for another 3 or 4. It becomes a blur after a while. We have a full roster of events at this point where I have something happening almost every night of the week, and sometimes during the day, Saturdays and Sundays during the day. Tonight there's a rope party going on. Tomorrow is our weekly orgy gangbang. Mm-hmm. Thursday's a poly support group. Friday is our weekly naughty karaoke. And on Saturday, the fourth Saturday each month, is Queerly Beloved, which is our queer and allies party. And you are doing Sex Ed Sunday on next Sunday.
Right. I'm teaching a class on BDSM and spirit or transcendence. And play that basically has a goal beyond, oh, it's so hard to describe, but basically play that is ceremonial, play that's ritually constructed.
More than just taking somebody out and beating the tar out of them and then
although I guarantee
Netflix.
You, I mean, if I take someone out and beat the tar out of them, they do have a life-altering experience.
Hopefully a spiritual euphoria of some sort.
Well, there's something very transforming about euphoria. We don't have enough of it in the world that we live in.
That's
most
correct.
Of us work way too hard for way too few rewards.
That is certainly true.
Yeah.
And while I am not rolling in money, though I am open to that at some point, the big payoff for us is definitely the community, the people that come to the space, and the stories of transformation that I don't just hear, I see. It's been amazing watching people come in, let's say someone just starting to transition, and then watching them over the years as they become more confident and, you know, further on their path, and we see those on the daily.
You know, my whole stereotype of a play party before I ever went to one was that it would be this sort of unbridled atmosphere of license where extreme behavior prevailed. And instead what I found were these community-based gatherings where there was a lot of friendship, affinity, mutual caretaking, humor, good music, cute costumes, and that it became a way to socialize each other, to teach each other, to learn new things to do, and that it all went a lot deeper than I thought it would.
I think a lot of people are surprised by that. People that come to our Wednesday parties, for instance, are more in a swinger culture, and they come to other parties, and it's very interesting to see those cultures and the etiquettes kind of overlap. They do not expect, again, we're back to consent. Consent is so important in the BDSM community. I think that we contribute to that at Catalyst because we have a pretty non-threatening environment, too. We call ourselves a living room with a dungeon. And that's kind of what we look like, a huge living room with a lot of couches. People can sit and hang out. It's very non-threatening. Then you can go into the dungeon if you want to see something wild going on. You can leave if you would like to recalibrate. But that's how people connect, is that it's not just all about sex or just all about being whipped or who's got the hottest boots or the tightest corset.
Right. Well, actually, if you're interested in some of these issues around consent, the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom put a consent summit on just a couple weeks ago, and we're hoping that the material from that conference will be available on their website, so that might be something people would want to check out.
Yeah, there are consent summits throughout the country. So ncsfreedom.org is their URL.
I knew you would know the URL. I don't know the URLs of anything.
That's because I never leave the internet.
Yes, it's true. You are in charge of making the internet behave.
I am the spirit in the machine.
How do, Dark Lady, how do folks find Catalyst?
CatalystSexPositive.com is our website. We have a calendar of events and a little information about us and what we're doing. We're on Facebook. We're on FetLife. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're everywhere you want to be.
Patrick, I'm going to concentrate all this in one, quote, one thought. This is something you said a couple of years ago, that you like to study a single bottom, find out what they like, take them apart like a radio to see how they work.
I did say that, didn't I?
Is that why there's little bits and pieces of me scattered throughout your apartment?
Well, it's, you know, I'm a psychologically oriented person, and the most interesting question I can ask about anybody is why? Not just what do you like, but why do you like it? And I think there's a certain amount of curiosity that's sort of built into sadism and dominance both, and so I prefer longer term connections where I have the leisure to explore the way that someone is put together. I'd like to think that my interest has a healing and an improving effect. I don't think all of my exes would agree with that, but there's a clinical component to it, I think. Yeah, certainly, of examining another person's desire. And I think that the other part of it is that if you have that clinical remove, you also, for me at least, it became a coping mechanism for my gender issues, because if someone else's desire was front and center and that was what we were deconstructing, then my own stuff, my own vulnerability, could be kept in the wings and was not as much a topic of examination. Does that make sense? You're kind of looking a little puzzled.
Not puzzled. It's strikes a strong chord with me.
Ah, yeah. Yes. Yes. It's interesting that you picked that one quote. Are you interested in what motivates people to become tops, or?
Well, I think that was such an explicit and visual way of you putting that what that relationship looks like from your perspective.
It's not very nice, is it?
Well,
doesn't sound very nice, but my intention certainly is not to be harmful. I mean, I've worked with several people who I felt had been through some pretty significant sexual trauma. And so, you know, it's not just about reducing people to the status of an object and trying to get a good diagram of their working parts. It's also about seeing where past pain and injury mm-hmm. has become built into certain limits that that person might put on how close they can be to others, whether they can experience full release or not. And then once I'm able to see that chart, that diagram, I'm able to make some interventions and see if I can't use pain in the present moment to vent and hopefully remove unresolved pain from the past.
Well, there's a lot of catharsis, I think, in being able to go into a situation that may be physically or emotionally uncomfortable and know that you have the right and the option this time of making that stop or slow down or intensify, as opposed to having those behaviors acted upon without consent.
Right. And I think our fears can be so limiting. One of the great things about kink is that it offers you the opportunity to find out if really it would be such a terrible thing if your fears came true. For example, if someone has a terrible fear of being out of control and insatiable, well, you know, what would happen if you were in a situation where you could have as much as you wanted and nobody else was standing there judging you or going, well, you have to stop now because this is really too much. I think then you're able to recalibrate and sort of come to a point where you understand your own real desires as opposed to your projections and fears about your desires, and just set those expectations in a more freeing place.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah. It would be great if it was always that easy.
Oh, where would the fun be then? Half the challenge is figuring your stuff out.
Yeah, it's so true.
Well, we just have a minute or so left, and I wish we'd gotten to talk about how, you know, what language means in all of this and how it changes and what we make of it. That's something a question I can't ask in 60 seconds.
That's a whole meta-analysis, mm-hmm. isn't it?
It is.
I could always come back.
You're absolutely welcome.
We could talk about talking.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your reverence for the word.
Thank you. Last thoughts. Remind us again that your talk at Catalyst, Patrick, is November 3rd, 4th?
It is. Let me pull up my calendar.
I thought it was on this Sunday.
It is not this Sunday.
Oh, well.
No, this Sunday is the October...
I thought it was the day after Queerly Beloved.
Which is on the 26th.
Okay.
And then, yes, Sunday the 27th.
Okay. So that's a presentation at Catalyst. You can get more information about that from my Facebook page or by looking up Catalyst on Facebook or on FetLife or by going to the URL for their website.
Yes, we have the information on the calendar on the website, catalystsexpositive.com. BDSM and Ritual. Ritual and BDSM with Patrick Califia.
Yeah.
From 1 until 3 p.m.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick and Teresa. Sorry, I merged your names together there.
Oh, my God, it's like Brangela.
Patrick, Teresa, thank you so much. Okay. We'll see you and everybody else, the whole world, at Thrill the World on Saturday.
Yay, zombie makeup. Yay.
Catholic Gated Conversations is up next. Thanks to Somia for making all of this possible in the booth. Blessings, everyone.
Homeless people, they're some of the most vulnerable and misunderstood folks in our communities. Season 3 of Local Folks Podcast, Helping the Homeless, is dedicated to telling the story of how a group of local people is working to provide needed services to folks who are experiencing homelessness. Episode 1 introduces the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center and the people at the center who give and receive help and support. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studio in Portland. Educata Ya hosts Dia de los Muertos featuring decorative altars, people dressed up as Katrinas, reading of the satirical Calaveras, and a traditional Pan de Muerto. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studios, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.